Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
All right, 8:15, typical summertime. We've had some rain early, then we might not have some rain, then we might have some more after, and it's going to be the same thing tomorrow, even though they're saying less of a chance for showers. I really do think at this time of year, the meteorologists just kind of alter it with a 30% or a 40% just to make it seem something different, but we all know what it's going to be like, but the tropics are quiet, so we'll take it. Alex Hammerstone joins us, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. Here we go again. How you doing, Alex?
Not bad. How are you this morning?
16 billion passwords leaked in a massive data breach. This Yahoo story tells me that it's shocked cybersecurity researchers. Usernames, emails, passwords for Apple, Google, Facebook, and more. Data even contained credentials of government officials posing security concerns. How concerned are you?
I'm always concerned in general, right? I maintain a general baseline level of concern. But I think for this specific kind of story that's out there about the 16 billion credentials, it's a bit of a non-story. And the reason why is that, you know, as we know, there are breaches constantly happening, right? We see them on the news all the time. We get the emails about it. We get letters in the mail about it from companies we work with. And what happens is that, you know, both criminals and researchers kind of aggregate all that breach information, you know, all those lost credentials, all those lost usernames and passwords into large databases, right? And they have for years. And they use those for kind of good and evil, right? So they use them to kind of research passwords, how people create them and keep track of these things. And what this sounds like is one of those databases that kind of aggregated all the breach information over the years was exposed on the internet for a bit. Some researchers saw that, and that's kind of where this claim of 16 billion credentials came from. So yes, they exist, and they're out there, but it's not as though there was a new data breach that suddenly released all these.
So I see a guy quoted as saying this is the mother of all data breaches, but what you're telling me is the data had already been breached, and this was from one collection site that it was stolen, so it made it like one stop breaching?
Correct. So it's kind of an aggregation of all these breaches that are out there. And keep in mind, I mean, you know, and some may be, you know, newer and some may contain passwords that are still in use, but some of these are probably older as well. As I said, I always kind of maintain a baseline level of concern and alarm, kind of given all the news in the cybersecurity world. But for anyone out there that's kind of listening and concerned, you know, there's a number of things we can do, right? As we talk about a lot, you know, don't reuse passwords. And by that, I mean, don't use the same password for multiple sites, right? Because then if it's breached in one site, that can affect you on other sites where you're using it. Use strong passwords. We always recommend passphrases. So, you know, sentences or things like that instead of those random combinations of letters and numbers. And then the really big one is
wait, say that part again. Say that part again, Alex, what you said about random combination instead of what? With the passwords?
So a lot of times you're better off just mathematically using a string of dictionary words, as long as it's a long string or a song lyric that's hard to guess, as opposed to kind of a short string of random letters and numbers.
Let me slow down a little bit here. So when I log on to something, whatever it is, you need a password for everything. You order a freaking pizza, you need a password, which I don't quite understand, but okay, fine. So if that's the case, and sometimes it says, I guess it's Google, Chrome, whomever it is, says, you know, do you want to use this password that they suggest? And it's alphanumeric, and it's upper lowercase. They got a little bit of Cyrillic language in there as well. I don't know what it is, but I should use that or I should not use that. It would be better to put some words together like advocate, political, conflict, and cyber, for example.
So when you get a suggested password like that through one of your services, those are usually pretty great, right? Those are going to meet all the requirements. I'm referring to if you're asked to create your own password, is that if you think about it, you know, kind of 8 random letters and numbers and symbols versus, you know, a 30 character sentence that only you would know. And you can throw in some additional attributes, like have every first word be capitalized and use at signs for A's. And those are much easier to remember and are going to end up being more secure than some of those random strings. Yeah.
As you talked
I'll
about.
Also say.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No.
I was going to say the other thing is with logging in to order pizza, I will say I have so many pizza points because I've got teenagers. So I get free pizza all the time. So I'm happy to log into any pizza account.
I don't understand that. Why do you have to have a password when you order pizza? What are they trying to do there? I'm not trying to sound like an old fogey. It's irritating, and it's good because it's prevented me from ordering pizza because it's like I'm not dealing with all of this.
I think everyone wants you to have an account on their site, right? Because they want to capture your data and your buying history and your information. You know, when you sign up for your pizza account, I'm sad to admit I have many of them around here. But you know, that way they kind of know who's ordering pizza. They can send you coupons. You know, they can kind of. As I said, I earn a lot of. I have a free pizza card in my on my sun visor in my car that they stamp every time I order a pizza. So,
and sometimes when you buy clothing or whatever it is, they ask you to register to get your 15% coupon, and then you got to give them your number. And if you do that, then you get the offer. But then you also open yourself up to text messages. And I guess what I'm wondering is, in exchange for that coupon, are you then providing them with information that they sell to somebody else, and then that increases the text that you get, the spam, the whatever you get?
Most likely, you know, it really depends on the company, right? So some bigger companies won't sell your data. Others do. You know, none of us read the user agreements when we sign up for stuff. It's just a fact of the matter. You know, I work in this industry and I don't read them. I'm not going to read a 20-page user agreement.
Would you understand it?
I probably wouldn't understand it anyway.
There you go. So what's the point? I'm not trying to take up for people that don't read them. I'm just saying, if you're not going to understand it, why waste the time?
I'm right with you. And you know, and the fact of the matter is, I just think, like a lot of modern consumers, I'm willing to trade my name and address and my, you know, my email address for 25% off a pair of shorts. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate, but that's kind of how it is.
But when you do that, they are using that information not just to sell you a pair of pants, but to sell to other people the information they collect, correct?
Oftentimes, yes. Not in every case, but oftentimes, yes. So, you know, there's this whole industry of data brokers that kind of just buy and sell this data and use it to market.
8:22 now. We'll take a break. We can come back. I'm going to talk to you about, as it relates to the data that's out there, and maybe comparing it to a document dump, if you will. And the other thing is, I'm looking at this Yahoo story, and they have a picture of this hacker with a hoodie on and a mask, and it looks like something out of The Strangers. Who was the girl they were asking for in The Strangers when they knocked on the door? Do you remember? Have you ever seen the movie, Alex, or not?
I don't remember. I forget.
They've got about 15 different versions of it, and it's always the same. Anyway, but that's not who the traditional hacker is, I don't think. We'll talk about that and more when we come back. Alex Hammerstone, direct.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Story about 16 billion passwords exposed, but they were already exposed and they were leaked or at least hacked from one site that was already, I guess, a hacking site. I don't know. 8:22 traffic now, WWL. 8:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Talking to Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. About a recent data breach, 16 billion passwords leaked in a massive data breach. However, Alex, and again, I want to make sure I'm saying the right thing, this is data that was already breached, and was that a data breach storage site that was hacked or not?
Correct. So it looks like these are all kind of passwords and usernames that were in previous data breaches and then were aggregated into this database. So, now, there, as I said, and there are a number of these databases out there that kind of aggregate all the different information from these breaches over the years, and it looks like that's what this was.
So as you said that, the idea popped into my mind about a document dump, which for people who don't know, it's like, okay, you want the documents? Here's the documents. We bury you in paper where we send trucks and trucks and boxes of paper over to you. Good luck going through it in time for the deadline. You wanted it, you got it. But at any point, does the data breach become a document dump where there is so much out there, it's hard for the people that are looking for data to find it, or is that idiotic? I don't know. It may be idiotic. You can tell me.
So I think with any electronic list, right, I mean, it takes a fraction of a second to search, right? You could search for either one of us in there, something like that. You know, I think that when you have this much information, you probably do have a lot of, you know, passwords that are old or usernames that are old and are no longer active. So it's with that many, there probably is a lot of information that's not really that useful to an attacker. So that certainly could be one way to look at it.
And I guess the other question is for people that are listening right now, okay, you got my data. What are you going to do with it?
So it really depends on what it is, right? And you know, we always recommend that people use multi-factor authentication, right? And that's, you know, the thing where you get a code texted to your phone or, you know, even better, you know, you're using an authenticator app on your phone or something like that, especially for your most important accounts, like your email and your banking and things like that. And what that means is that even if an attacker has your username and password, they still can't log into your account because they're not going to know that code, right? They're not going to. So I think everyone's pretty familiar at this point with that kind of multi-factor authentication. But that's one of the most important things you can do. You know, anywhere that offers it, use that multi-factor authentication.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate your time as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. We'll talk to you in a week or so when there's another massive data breach. Dane Cialino joins us as we come back, Professor of Law at Loyola. We'll talk about Louisiana's Ten Commandments Law. Where does that stand? We'll let you know right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 844, 16 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Whenever we have a question about law or legal proceedings, Dane Cialino is our go-to guy, professor of law at Loyola. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Take me back, if you will, for people that remember a little bit about it, because I think the latest thing is we're besieged by 7,200 messages a day or something like that. People that remember something about the Ten Commandments and the legislature and schools and so forth, and tell me how we got to where we are now, and then we'll talk about where we are now.
Yeah, during the 2024 session last year, the legislature passed a bill that the governor signed into law requiring public schools to post the Ten Commandments in classrooms. And then that was challenged by some plaintiffs supported by the ACLU and other organizations. The district court, federal district court in Baton Rouge, found that the law was unconstitutional because it violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, because there is a U.S. Supreme Court case right on point from 1980 that says you can't do that. The plaintiffs, winning, were pleased, of course, but the state appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit last week on Friday ruled that the district court got it right, that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause prohibits the public display in public schools of the Ten Commandments, and that's where we are today. We're told that the state is going to seek en banc review from the entire Fifth Circuit, and then ultimately they're going to go to the Supreme Court, who will may or may not decide the issue.
You said a lot of stuff there as a professor of law. Let me go back and rewind a little bit. You talked about Establishment Clause, and for people that are thinking, I'm just going to try to channel the audience in, or saying, you know what, we're a Christian nation. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just saying what people are thinking and what they text in. We're a Christian nation. Why not have the Ten Commandments? And Ten Commandments, I don't think, has anything to do with being a Christian nation. But either way, thoughts on that, Dane, and the Constitution?
Yeah, well, the First Amendment says what it says, and there's longstanding case law that says that we cannot have entanglements between government and religion. And even though historically we are a Christian nation, the founders adopted the First Amendment and its establishment and free exercise clause to have some separation between church and state. And it's been debated for 250 years how much separation is appropriate. the debate still goes on today, but the Establishment Clause says what it says, and the state cannot adopt a religion or endorse a religion in a way that essentially forces it on people in public schools.
So let me ask you this, not to be an arguer or anything, but when you say history shows we were I founded as a Christian nation, I don't know what that means. That means that most of the people in the country at the time were Christians, or?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly weren't, we didn't bake Christianity into the United States Constitution. In fact, quite the opposite. But
And I'm not trying to be disrespectful here. We certainly weren't a Muslim nation. We certainly weren't a Jewish nation. We certainly weren't a pick-your-own-religion here, a Buddhist nation, right? Right?
Yeah, I mean, historically, and religion back then played a much bigger role in the day-to-day lives of citizens than it does today. But again, those are all the historical, that's the historical context. But in that context, the founders did just the opposite of what maybe some would think, which is to try to put up a wall of debatable thickness and height, a wall between church and state.
So when it comes to the different courts, take me through that slowly here, and because people try to understand the hierarchy of courts, be it state courts, district courts, federal courts, et cetera. Where was this action brought?
Yeah, this was brought in federal district court in Baton Rouge, the lowest tier of federal courts. And it was really quite an easy decision, really, for the United States district judge in that case, because this is one of these perhaps rare occasions where there is absolutely on point Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court precedent on the exact issue presented. And that was the 1980 case out of Kentucky that ruled squarely that you cannot order public schools to post the Ten Commandments. That's what that 1980 decision says. So the district court in Baton Rouge just applied the law as announced by the United States Supreme Court in 1980. Now, the reason that it was something of a horse race and perhaps remains that today is that the U.S. Supreme Court about 3 or 4 years ago in a case called Bremerton, Kennedy or Bremerton, whatever you'd like to call it, said that the test for a violation of the Establishment Clause is different than what it's been since the early 70s. The new test of whether a statute violates the Establishment Clause is whether or not there is a history and tradition of the practice that even though it might have some religious nature, if there's a history and tradition that supports it, then it might pass constitutional muster. And that's the toehold that the Attorney General is trying to use to get this 1980 opinion overruled by the Supreme Court. But that can't happen until it gets to the Supreme Court, and that's where she's hoping to bring this.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Dane Cialino. The Attorney General, Liz Merle, is requesting an en banc review. What does that mean? We'll find out when Dane Cialino rejoins us after this break. Right now, 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 8:55, 5 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Dane Cialino about a professor of law at Loyola about Louisiana's Ten Commandment law that was passed in 2024 that a district, help me out, Dan, I don't want to hurt myself here, a district court struck down?
A district court struck down, and the United States Fifth Circuit last week affirmed.
So the Fifth Circuit is on Camp Street, and right?
Correct.
And we all pass it, but I don't think we quite realize what it consists of. How many judges are there? Who is it that heard this Ten Commandments case, and who is it that Liz Merle would like to hear this Ten Commandments case?
Yeah, it was heard by a three-judge panel, which is typical on a federal appeal, and now she's asked for the entire court to review it. It's called en banc or in bank, which is every judge in active service of the court to hear it as a panel of the whole, essentially. I believe there are somewhere between 12 and 14 judges that are active now. I'm not sure of the exact number, but something along those lines. I was a little surprised, actually, that she asked for en banc review because she surely understands that the only court that can give her relief, the relief that she wants, which is a decision that the statute doesn't violate the First Amendment. The only court that could give her that relief is the United States Supreme Court. And the only way the United States Supreme Court can do it is by overruling its own precedent from 1980, which is something that doesn't happen terribly often. But this court has not been shy. This Roberts Court has not been shy about overruling precedent. Like, for example, we saw the overruling of Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs case. So that's why I'm surprised. I would think she would want to get this case as quickly as possible to the United States Supreme Court. She doesn't have to seek en banc review from the Fifth Circuit to do that. But nonetheless, that's what she's done.
If she does go, if she does seek that and has the en banc review, that delays it getting the Supreme Court, because surely if the en banc review is in her, favor of her, the other side is going to appeal, or then the Supreme Court could choose not to hear it, and then it becomes law, Dane?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would be surprised if number one, she seeks en banc review, although she said that she plans to do that. And I would even be more surprised if the Fifth Circuit en banc overruled the panel decision or reversed the panel decision. I just don't think that's going to happen. Ultimately, this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, which doesn't even have to take up the case. It's not an appeal to the United States Supreme Court. It's she would file a petition for certiorari, which is essentially asking the court to, in its discretion, decide to take up the case and review it, which is certainly not a foregone conclusion. There's a good chance the court would just leave this issue alone and let the Fifth Circuit panel opinion stand, which, of course, struck down the law as unconstitutional.
So when it comes to the historical argument there, if they say it is allowable under the historical context, does that open a door for other things to be included or posted in classrooms because they were intrinsic to the history of the country?
Yeah, possibly. And remember, that's the way that this law was drafted. It ostensibly, the law is trying to be make itself look consistent with the history and tradition, and having the Ten Commandments posted in the context of history was kind of an all too obvious attempt to shoehorn this law into this developing Establishment Clause jurisprudence.
I don't know if you're in the prediction business or not, but if the Roberts Court were to take this up, do you have any idea how they'd rule?
Yeah, I think it'd be a close call. I think it's more likely they're just not going to take it up and leave it alone. But I think it would be a close call. They probably would not overrule the 1980 existing case law. But again, who knows? You could guess as well as me, Tommy.
Thank you, Dane. That's right. I appreciate it. Well, two brilliant legal minds. Sure, why not? Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. We'll come back, talk to an advocate recruiter for Casa Jefferson about how much good you can do as a CASA volunteer. And we'll talk with Judy Ho. We talk about mental health all the time, about relationships between grown children, grown parents, and more.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.